Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Artist First World Radio Network, home of the best new music you've never heard, and home of the best new talk shows you need to hear. Please don't forget to visit our archives page at www.artistfirst.com, where you can hear all our past shows for free and on demand. You are tuning in to Chit Chat Cafe Live. The show airs at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time every Thursday. For more information about this show and to listen to past shows for free, please visit artistfirst.com/chitchat.htm. And don't forget to follow Artist First on Twitter. You can find us under the Twitter handle, @artist_first. And now here are your hosts of Chit Chat Cafe Live, Lisa, Nancy, and Betty Ann.
Hi, everyone. Nancy. We are just so honored and excited tonight. Lisa and Betty Ann and I have been doing hours of research. We have the book in our hand, Imperfect Justice, Prosecuting Casey Anthony. Aren't we thrilled, girls?
Unbelievably.
Oh, we watched hours and hours. That's all we talked about. And as mothers, we just are in shock still. So without further ado, everyone grab your glass of wine or whatever you'd like to have as your beverage of choice. Sit back and relax. And we'd like to welcome to the show the prosecuting attorney for the Casey Anthony case, Jeff Ashton. Hello, Jeff.
Hello, hello, and thank you for having me.
Oh, we are just so honored. What a privilege to have you on our show. We feel like we know you. We've been in our living rooms for how many hours? And
months, yeah. Months and months.
Right. Seriously, we feel like we know you.
Yeah, it is interesting how being on TV, 8 hours a day for 6 weeks does tend to have that effect on people.
Well, we're so proud of you. We were just cheering for you, and you were the star of it all in our hearts.
Well, thank you so much. That's very sweet.
We have a bunch of research and questions for you, of course. I'd like to start off. I'm Nancy. And first of all, we've discussed, as mothers, a mother's love for a child, the bond is just so strong. Would you please share your thoughts about Casey, especially not reporting Kaylee missing sooner than those 30 days?
Well, it's interesting you say that because I've always thought that was the thing that really captured people and made them, watch this drama unfold. I think the one thing that most people still believe in, we don't believe in politicians anymore, we don't believe in lawyers anymore, but the one thing people still believe in is that bond, what you're saying, between a mother and a child. I think for a lot of people, it was trying to figure out how that bond broke down that was so fascinating about this case. And it was to me, too. I mean, I could never, wrap my head around any circumstance in which a mother could, allow her child to be missing for 30 days or dead or anything else and act the way that Casey did. And I think that's the part that everyone still is trying to wrestle with.
Especially, I just cannot believe that you're exactly right.
Well, this is Lisa. I have a question for you. This is really an honor to have you on here. Honestly, I'm really flabbergasted that we're talking to you. This is so cool.
Well, thank you, Lisa.
In the book, you show a picture of Casey's tattoo, Bella Vita. What did you think of that tattoo? Like, what did you think it meant?
Well, the literal translation of Bella Vita in Italian, as we have been led to understand it, is beautiful life. But, the common, average 20-year-old in Orlando, Florida, what that means is the good life. It means the good life, the life you want. And to me, it was always very clear that, when Casey got that tattoo, it was an expression of how she felt about her life without her daughter, and that it was the good life. And I talk in a little bit in the book about the one rather lame explanation that one of the psychiatrists relayed about the tattoo, that somehow it was some sort of ironic commentary on the fact that her life had not been beautiful. you know, that Casey had said to him, which I thought was just absolutely ludicrous. And everything we knew said indicated that when she went and got that too, she was just happy as can be. And it seemed to be an honest expression of how she felt, you know. She was enjoying her life without Kaylee and without her parents.
Sick.
Wow. It is bizarre.
Crazy. Hi, Jeff. This is Betty Ann.
Hey, Betty Ann. How are you?
Good, good. So great to talk to you tonight. I previously had been a court reporter for about 25 years, so I don't like to watch a lot of court cases on television now because I've seen it for over and over again in my lifetime,
mm-hmm.
but I watched the whole trial. Of course, I watched everything from the very beginning when Kaylee went missing because it was just such a bizarre, unusual case. And, you know, the amount of lies and changing stories, it was just bizarre. I wanted to ask you, there was something mentioned about a nuclear lie. What was the nuclear lie?
What was that? The nuclear lie was sort of our phrase for what we were expecting. I mean, we knew what Casey's pattern was. We knew that, you know, when push came to shove, she would always come up with some new story or some variation on the story. So we always had speculated what was going to be the big bomb, that, you know, the nuclear lie. And so when we finally heard it, it you know, combined elements of everything we had speculated would be. You know, we guessed that it would probably blame George because he was the only one that was there at the time that Kaylee was last seen. You know, we suspected it might include a drowning involved, but it really took us by surprise when we found out what her actual story was, which was not simply to involve George, but to blame him for murdering Kaylee. That was a surprise to us. But, yeah, we thought that was the big one.
Wow. I mean, do you think that is something that she came up with after, or she had been planning that all along?
No, I mean, my impression and basically her pattern was that she would make it up as needed. So I believe what happened was that she, you know, waited until she saw what the evidence was over the progression of the years. And I think she came to a point when she realized, you know, sort of, I use the analogy of that the walk down the universal hallway. You know, she got to the end of the hall, metaphorically, and realized that this lie of blaming a stranger simply wasn't going to work. There's no way, because there was so much evidence connecting Kaylee's body to the house that she had to come up with a new one. And I think that was the genesis of this whole George molested me story.
Unbelievable.
Well, that is just amazing. Well, what do you think about, do you think Casey Anthony did kill her daughter?
Yeah, I mean, to me, you know, in figuring out any kind of a case, any kind of investigation, you think through what are the possible scenarios and find one that explains all the evidence. And in this case, there's only one. The only scenario that explains all the evidence in the case is that Casey killed her daughter for a reason that we don't fully understand, because we don't have a full understanding of the relationship between Casey and Cindy. You know, neither one of them has ever been candid, really candid, about that relationship. We know from friends and coworkers and people that it was a very strained relationship, that it was very hostile at times, that Cindy was on the verge of you know, taking, perhaps trying to take Kaylee away from Cindy. So, you know, neither one of them would admit it in court or in the investigation. You know, that's the genesis of this crime, is the relationship between the two of them. And I believe that there came a point in time when Casey, at some level, convinced herself that, you know, that this was best for everyone. I mean, it's a classic situation you see in infanticide cases, where you typically have a mother who is at some risk of losing the child and convinces herself that the child is in danger from this other person. Typically, it's an ex-husband, ex-wife situation where the husband is fighting for custody and the mother convinces herself that, you know, that father is going to endanger the child or molest the child or something like that. And so, you know, the child is better off dead. This is the mindset. So I believe that Casey convinced herself of that somehow, you know, she didn't want Kaylee to be in her life, and to leave her with her parents was somehow a fate worse than death, and that really it was better for everybody that Kaylee be dead. And, you know, once she convinced herself of that, I believe that she just basically put Kaylee to sleep with chloroform, because we found that in the trunk, and then very humanely, think about it, suffocated her with the duct tape, put her in her favorite baby blanket, and put in the trunk of the car, and then just went off to start her new life.
Oh, my God.
And I know it's hard to imagine because it's so disturbing, but, you know, it's the only explanation that covers all the evidence in the case. All the other ones, you know, don't account for each piece, and that's the one that makes sense. To me, anyway.
Ugh. Craziness.
It is.
What did Casey tell those two therapists who examined her with regards to who murdered Kaylee? What did she say?
Basically, her story to them was that George had been molesting her from a young age. One of the therapists, she told that the molestation ended, you know, in her early teen years, but to the other one, she claimed that the molestation continued sporadically, even up to the point of Kaylee's conception, to the point that she thought that Kaylee might actually be George's child.
That's sick.
It is. It's just so disturbing. But basically, the story she told was essentially that, you know, she would sleep with Kaylee in her bed because she was so concerned about George molesting her, that on this particular morning, she was awakened by George from a very, very deep sleep, sort of almost suggesting that she might have been drugged without saying it. George saying that, where's Kaylee, that he then walks back in with Kaylee, soaking wet, that her clothing is different than it was when she went to bed. That was a big point for Casey in the story to one of the psychologists. And she also went to great lengths to describe that George's clothing was wet, like from the waist up. In other words, the way the therapist took it was she was saying that, indicating that he had, like, bent over into the water to drown Kaylee, not jumped into the pool to save her. That was kind of, in her mind, why that was important. And she basically told the therapist, there's no way that Kaylee could have drowned by accident, that she could not have gotten into the pool, that's not possible, and that she was murdered by George, either deliberately or somehow drowned in the act of molesting her. So she basically said it was murder, but tried to blame her father for it.
Wow. Jeff, I wanted to ask you a question about Casey Anthony's behavior in court. Did she act differently when the jury was in the room than when they were not present? Like,
She frequently did, yes. You know, you'd frequently see a very emotional, very sort of drawn-looking, morose expression on her face when the jury was there, you know, bordering sometimes into open sobbing. But when the jury was out of the room, generally she was, you know, talkative and chatty and sort of like, you know, the Casey Anthony we saw in all the pretrial hearings, where, you know, she was always very involved and that kind of thing. So, it's very clear that she was, at least to me, that she was, you know, playing for the jury. And, of course, her attorneys were also, you know, chiming in whenever she would start the crocodile tears. They would be, you know, all over her with the hugging and the holding and all of that kind of stuff. So it was quite a performance.
I'll tell you, when I would see that, I just wanted to, like, smack her.
Yeah. Well, I know how you feel.
And I just can't believe anybody would fall for that. I mean, it was just, to me, obvious. Obviously,
well, You're right. I mean, it's part of what you hope is that jurors will see through that kind of thing, but they don't always. And this jury, I don't know if they interpreted it that way or how they did, but it certainly didn't help.
Well, you've also pointed out, even for the fact that perhaps her chair was lower.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty funny. I noticed that a day or two into the trial that because, you know, I'd seen her for many, many days in hearings and all that. So I had, you know, she's a very slight person. She's only about, I think, you know, 5'2 or something. But, you know, I'd seen her before sitting at the table and, you know, sitting in a position where she could write and all that. And I noticed in the trial that they had lowered her chair to the point that the table was almost up to the mid-chest area. So she looked like, you know, a little tiny kid. And so, yeah, they definitely played her. And like you said, you should expect that. And you would expect a jury to be able to overlook that and to understand it. But, you know, we don't know whether they did or not.
Well, especially, you know, with her hair, the way it was, the whole trial, like a school marm.
Yeah.
And then for the sentencing, it was down and fluffy.
Yeah, it was almost like she was saying to the rest of the world, look at the real me now. I'm going to shine. It was
unbelievable.
Disturbing. Yeah, it was.
Mm. What are your feelings about Cindy Anthony?
You know, I have a number of different feelings. I at some level, I will always feel sympathy for Cindy somewhat because obviously, you know, I don't think she deserved to be involved in this, and I think losing her granddaughter was very traumatic for her. But by the same token, Cindy is the one person who could have given this jury the truth about the relationship between she and Casey. And I think given the jury an insight into why this happened, and I think at some level she owed that to Kaylee. You know, she owed the truth. And I think...
Poor little girl, nobody... That's what made me so sad.
Yeah.
The poor little girl had nobody.
Right, and that is true. You know, well, you know, that it's true in a way and it's not. She didn't have them, but she had 100,000 other people.
Right, you're right.
So that sort of replaced them in a way. But yeah, you know, that's the real sad thing, is that I think we could have really gotten to the truth a lot better had Cindy not been in such a state of denial.
What did you think of George? Do they look like a nice couple to you in person, or do they look like they're something nutty about them? I couldn't tell. They look like a nice, normal couple when you
see them.
They did. Like, you know, they're, you know, well-dressed and not bad, not crazy looking. Well, what did they look like in person? Like, did they look like nice people? Or
They did. They looked very normal. I mean, they seem to be a very normal couple. You know, and really, when you look at that family, and you take away Casey and everything related to her, they actually are a pretty normal bunch. I mean, they're both well liked at work. They have friends who respect them. They seem to be honest people, trustworthy people for the most part. There's just something about Casey. It's just sort of a toxin in that relationship that is really, really hard to assess. It is also interesting to me that they're very, in a way, very meticulous in their appearance, in the sense of you know, their home and their yard and their personal appearance. They always look very, very groomed. You know, every part of their life seemed very, very groomed and maintained as an image. And you always wonder a little bit, you know, what is behind all of that? Is there something else that's being, you know, hidden by all that grooming? But I mean, I spent a fair amount of time with them, and you know, I think they basically, had Casey never been born, I think they would just be your average couple next door.
What a shame.
It is.
Jeff, can you explain why George and Cindy were not outraged that Casey was accusing her father, George, of the molestation. I mean, like, they had no expression at all. It was...
Well, they did, though. I mean, they... you know, I was present. We had, and I talk in the book about this, it's a fairly long story, but we had made arrangements for them to learn the truth of what Casey was saying about George and what happened to Kaylee. And we weren't in the room the moment the news was given to them because we wanted them to have privacy with their attorney to kind of process it. But we saw them, you know, within 5 or 10 minutes of that. And I could tell you that you know, George was just absolutely devastated by this. I mean, he was, I liken it to, he looked like Kaylee had died all over again. It was so horribly devastating to him. And Casey, and Cindy was actually supportive of him. I mean, you know, she was, you know, sort of holding his hand and saying, you know, no one believes this. But even with all of that, she still wasn't willing to really put any blame on Casey. And that was what the part that really amazed me, is that her attitude about Casey and these allegations was not, how could she do this to her father, but rather it was, I don't know what's wrong with her. You know, implying that there was some explanation or some illness involved. And it was just sort of a surprising to me that, you know, even at that, she couldn't see the evil part of her daughter. But that her denial was just so complete.
Yeah, try to explain away why she would accuse her father of molestation, or why she wouldn't let anybody know their daughter was missing for 30 days. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, she's like a major enabler.
It is. Yeah. That's a very good word for it. She is. It is a very codependent relationship, and it's clear that Cindy is an enabler. One of the things that I said in the book is the reason it's so easy to lie to Cindy is because she wants to be lied to. She doesn't want to see the truth. So she will accept anything.
No, probably the only truth that ever came out of her mouth was when she made that phone call and she said that it smelled like a dead body in the back of the car.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting.
And after that, it was over.
Right. I mean, it's fascinating to me that the dynamic of you know, it kind of reminded me of someone that would say, you know, I can insult my brother, but nobody else can. It's like if it was a matter of Casey keeping Cindy away from something that Cindy wanted, then she was all, you know, ready and, you know, ready to go, guns on her, wanted the police there, ready to see the truth. But once it became other people against Casey, then the denial came back, the protective mother came back, and she was, you know, unwilling to see the truth, even if it meant, you know, not finding out the truth about her daughter.
Unbelievable. So in the opening statements, Jose Baez talked about molestation, but then he didn't produce any evidence to back it up during the trial.
Yeah, it was amazing. You know, a lot of people have asked me about that and have asked me about sort of the ethical issues that raises. And what I've told them is, you know, an attorney has an obligation to not attempt to present evidence to a jury or suggest evidence to a jury that he doesn't have a good faith basis to believe that he can prove. So if, when he said that, he knew that he was not going to be able to prove it, that Casey was not going to testify, then that would be unethical. The problem is, we'll never know the answer to that, because that's based on their private communications. So, you know, if there was even a slight possibility that Casey would testify and say that, then it's not unethical. But it certainly, you know, I think for most of us, without a real certainty that you were going to be able to prove that, even if it's not unethical, I think most people would consider it really sleazy. You know, to accuse someone of something so horrendous without some pretty gosh darn strong proof. But you know, the thing is, that's what the jury is supposed to be able to look beyond and to see through. That was the amazing part of this case, is that, you know, you would expect a jury to take that and say, well, wait a minute, you told me that you were going to prove these horrible allegations, and you haven't. And generally, you'd expect the jury to go, well, I'm not going to trust that lawyer who has made that argument because, you know, you didn't prove any of it. For some reason, this jury didn't take it that way.
Why was the jury taken to where they found Kaylee's body?
We had talked about that amongst the prosecution team, what we call a jury view. And one of the key factors in deciding whether to do a jury view or not is whether the area that the jury is going to see has been changed in any way, whether it's the same as it was at the time relevant to the case. And the difficulty here was that the scene where Kaylee's body was found had been completely cleared at the time that she was found. And even at the time of trial, it was still substantially cleared. But worse than that, it was full of teddy bears and signs and all of these, you know, expressions of people's affection for Kaylee. For the jury to have seen that would have been a very huge problem for us, because it would have been, you know, it would have been expressions of other people's affection, and I there's no way the judge would have allowed us to do that. One, without clearing all that out, which, you know, wouldn't have felt right to us. But as another aside, since the area wasn't the same, to show them that area, I think would have given them a false impression that the place where Kaylee's body was found was more accessible and visible than it actually was. So we thought about all that, but we decided for a lot of reasons it just wasn't a good idea.
Just yeah. Creepy. And we just seeing her body, too, must have been... I can't believe that didn't sway the jurors at all.
Well, you know, that's to me, that was the most amazing thing. I remember when Linda and I were planning the opening statement in the case, you know, the only piece of evidence we had that the public had not seen was the photographs of Kaylee's remains and exactly how she was found. And for me, the photograph of that little skull down, you know, in that debris in the woods there, the swamp, with that duct tape, where you could actually see the duct tape peeking out from between all the fallen leaves, right there over her nose and mouth. To me, that was the case. That spoke everything. And I remember, you know, saying to Linda or thinking that, you know, when the jury sees that for the first time, that's got to affect them. I mean, that's just a very...
They've got to be crazy. How could that not have affected them?
But it doesn't appear to have. I mean, I remember watching them at the moment in the opening statement when Linda first put it up there on the screen, and I was expecting, you know, at least some reaction, and there was none from any of them. And I just was floored by that, you know, that didn't move them at all. And maybe that was a foreshadowing of what was to come.
I hope they all have nightmares every night. Go, Betty Ann, sorry.
I agree with what you said, Lisa. Jeff, do you feel that Jose Baez really believes that Casey Anthony is not guilty of murdering her daughter, Kaylee?
I don't know. I would have no idea what he believes or doesn't believe, honestly. And you know, most defense attorneys, for their own sanity, don't really ever ask themselves that question completely, you know, to decide something like that. So I don't know what he thinks or feels.
Okay. Go ahead, Nance.
Well, Jeff, if you could sit down right now with the jury face to face, what kind of questions would you ask them today?
The first question I would ask is I would ask them, well, how do you think that tape got there? Because that's, to me, always been the biggest question is, you know, there's only one reason that I can think of or that anybody else has ever suggested for why that duct tape was on her skull. There's just one, other than the ridiculous notion that Dr. Spitz said about somebody picking up the skull and playing with it, putting tape on it, which was idiotic. You know, there's just no reason, as Dr. Garavaglia said in trial, there's no reason to put duct tape on the face of a child, dead or alive, other than to suffocate them. So that's the first thing I would say to him. I would say, okay, you think this could have been an accident. why was that duct tape on there? And I'd love to hear what they said. The other question I would ask is I would ask them, well, what do you think Bella Vita means? Because to me it means, you know, I love my life. I love my life I'm living right now. It's the good life. I would love to know what they made of that. But the tape would be the big one. To me, that's the issue for me that's always been undeniable in showing that this was a murder, was that tape.
If Casey testified, and I'm sure you've been asked this a million times, and I'm sure you have a lot of answers to this, what would you have asked her?
Well, basically the same questions. I mean, you know, the cross examination, if she testified, was actually going to be done by Linda, my co-counsel, because we had talked a lot about it, and Linda is a fantastic cross examiner. She's a master. And we also felt that, you know, for the jury's image, it would be better for her to cross-examine her, because if I did it, there might be too much association with George, because we're both, you know, older men with gray hair and didn't want us connected together. But, you know, we had a good plan going. But the main thing, I think, would have been, you know, the tattoo. You know, just exactly what did that mean to you when you had it done? And, you know, ask a lot of questions about that. You know, the 31 days, I would love to question her day by day about what she did on each day and why she did it, what she thought about, you know, what was in your mind, what was in your heart. And I'd like to ask her about that darn duct tape, you know, same thing like with the jury. Well, why do you think that duct tape was there? So, you know, that would have been a lot of fun. That cross-examination would have been fun.
Jeff, do you think the testimony about the chloroform searches ultimately hurt the case?
I think it did, in the sense that the issue became the number of searches rather than the issue being that there was any search at all. So, yeah, I think it did a little bit. You know, I'm not sure with this jury it made that big a difference, because from all of the comments that the two jurors that have spoken have made, it's like that they didn't discuss much of anything beyond fact of the cause of death. They seem to have stuck on that point and stopped. So, you know, we don't really know what they made all of that about the chloroform in the trunk and the odor in the trunk and the searches on the computer. So we don't really know what they made of all that. But, yeah, it certainly was just... add that we got away from the issue of that there were searches at all and got stuck on this issue of how many there were. So that did, I think, hurt a little bit.
And then when Cindy testified that she did searches for chlorophyll and then it took her to chloroform, do you believe that she perjured herself?
I do. You know, we you know, the computer was checked, and there were no searches for chlorophyll on the computer. So I do believe that information, especially, you know, the chlorophyll versus chloroform, maybe that could have been, you know, just bad memory or confusion. I mean, you know, trying to give her the benefit of the doubt. The real place where I think it's undeniable is when she specifically said in trial, I searched for chloroform on this particular day and time. And we know that's not true because her work records and her computer shows she was at work. So on that issue, I do think that was a more deliberate lie, yes.
That's amazing.
But the jury believed her.
You know, they're a bunch of idiots.
Yeah, they were idiots. I mean, of all the jurors that could have been chosen for that case, it had to be them.
Oh, my God. Unbelievable.
Well,
I've
got your
listening.
Book in my hand. I just loved every moment of it. I have it highlighted in your book, Imperfect Justice. Jeff, you did take a couple of jabs at Jose Baez. What do you say about them now?
Hello?
We're having technical difficulties. We're going to take a commercial break.
And now back to Chit Chat Cafe Live.
Well, it's always good to take a break on live radio, especially when we've been talking for so long. Jeff, I have your book in my hand. I couldn't put it down. I have it very highlighted. I'm wondering, first of all, the cover. Your picture looks fabulous, and how did you decide on the pictures of Casey?
Well, actually, the publisher decided on the pictures of Casey. My first reaction was that I obviously didn't want pictures of Casey on the cover, but they explained to me that it was better that people would be better able to identify the book, and so I understood that, and they, you know, I accepted their wisdom as professionals that's who needed to be on the cover. The other picture was of me is just one from the trial. There was a couple of ones they gave me to choose from, and I chose what I thought was the least offensive one.
No, I like it. And I'm so happy that we have our precious angel, Kaylee, on the back cover.
Yeah, that was something that I really, really fought for and wanted to have her picture, you know, even if only on the back jacket, because it really is all about her. So I felt real strongly about that.
You're right. Well, I was asking you, in Imperfect Justice, you did take a couple of jabs at Jose Baez. What
Yes.
do you have to say about them?
Well, I mean, you know, I wrestled a lot with what to say about him and how blunt to be about my feelings. And I felt it was important to preface anything I would say with an admission of my own bias. I mean, I felt like the reader needed to know that when I was talking that I do not like the man, and here's why. You know, and there's a lot of things I talk about there, but the big thing to me is dishonesty. I you know, lawyers have an obligation to fight very, very hard for their clients and give their clients everything they can within the bounds of ethics. But one thing that lawyers have to always maintain is a sense of trustworthiness, both with the court and with opposing counsel. And that didn't, in my opinion, seem to mean much to him. And so that's not something that I can step out of the courtroom and shake hands and forgive, because that's a basic, you know, requirement of our profession is honesty and being trustworthy. So, you know, that's my biggest issue. I try to be fair and credit some good things he did, and he did do some good things. But, you know, the overwhelming impression that he left with me was negative, and I also don't want people who watch that to believe that his presentation is typical of defense attorneys. You know, I have many, many friends that are defense attorneys. There are thousands of honorable men and women that defend people, even very unpopular people, and that's an absolutely essential aspect of our criminal justice system. But, you know, those people do it within the bounds of ethics and with honor. And I just don't want people to look at that and say, you know, all those defense lawyers are just like that. And that is not true. He is not typical of defense attorneys.
Do you think Casey Anthony is purely evil? Or do you think she's just like a stupid, immature, 20-some jackass?
I don't think she's evil. I think she is selfish. I mean, I think that the predominant aspect of her personality is just a narcissism, a selfishness, a self-absorption. But when you combine that with somebody who is so adept at lying to others, I think you get to a point where you become good at lying to yourself. And I think her greatest gift is being able to do what's best for her, but rationalize that it's really best for everyone. And I think that is the real evil in her, is that self-absorption and the ability to rationalize. But I don't think that she kills for pleasure. I don't think she took pleasure in killing Kaylee. I think she did it in a humane way, but I think she took, she wanted something, and she couldn't have it with Kaylee. And so Kaylee had to be gotten out of the way in order for her to have what she wanted. So to me, that's just a basic, almost pathological narcissism rather than what we would call evil.
Mm-hmm. So
that he is.
Jeff, do you believe the death penalty was too harsh, a charge?
You know, there were a couple of parts of this book that were hard to write, and that was one that I spent some time thinking about. You know, I wanted people to understand the process that is involved in a prosecution in deciding when the death penalty is left as a possible sentence. And what I hope people came away with it was the idea that, you know, there was a process here, that the analysis was done, that there was a basis, a legal basis, for seeking the death penalty. But, you know, aside from it being legally sought, there is a practical question of whether it's likely to succeed or whether it's worth the time and trouble that it goes through. And, you know, ultimately that was someone else's decision. That was the elected state attorney's decision. And, you know, he had all the information and he made that decision. But I did feel it was important for me to be honest and say that my assessment was that it was very, very unlikely that she would ever get the death penalty. And, you know, in the last analysis, I probably would have been just as happy if it hadn't been a death penalty case. But I didn't feel bad that it was. I thought at some level she did deserve it, but just as a reality, I didn't think she'd ever actually get it.
You think maybe that's what swayed the jury to decide not guilty, because guilty would have meant death penalty?
Well, that's the interesting part that I also hope people will be educated about from the book, is that, you know, this jury ultimately was the ones who would decide whether she got the death penalty or not. The death penalty, and this was explained to the jury over and over again, the death penalty is not an automatic sentence when you're convicted of first-degree murder. You still have options. This jury could have found her guilty of first-degree murder but chosen not to give her death, and she couldn't have gotten it. They also had the option of finding her guilty of a number of different lesser offenses, second-degree murder, manslaughter, etc., in which the death penalty would have been impossible. She couldn't have gotten it. So, you know, there were plenty of options for this jury to punish her for the death of Kaylee with something less than death. So if any of them were to say that, my response would be, that's a cowardly cop-out. You know, you're not taking responsibility for this decision. And I have to trust that the jury followed the judge's instructions and didn't consider that.
That's amazing. Jeff, we do have an email from Gary, and he would like to know, what would have been the one or the largest deciding factor that lost the case for the prosecuting team?
Well, you know, my answer to that, after having sort of gone over this case in my own mind for as many months as I have, is I really think that the amount of pretrial publicity in the case eliminated from the potential pool of jurors most jurors that we would have wanted. You know, it's as if, you know, our entire case was laid out before the public, and all of those people that would have, you know, put the facts together the way we did, who would have seen what we saw in the facts and in her conduct and in the physical evidence, had already seen it. So they had already decided that she was guilty, and therefore those jurors could not be on the jury. So what you have left is either people who haven't seen the facts, which, you know, you have to live under a rock not to know about this case, or people who, having seen it, weren't persuaded by it or weren't judgmental enough to draw the conclusions that the rest of us do. So you basically have a panel of jurors that's skewed far, far in favor of the defendant. And, you know, one of the quotes that I saw from the foreman in one of his interviews, you know, he was talking about the opening statements of both sides, and he said, well, we heard the state's opening, and it was pretty much what we already knew. You know, that's a pretty devastating thing to come into a case and have a juror say, well, the state's case was what we already knew and weren't convinced by, so you pretty much are dead, you know, before you start. So, you know, that I think, if there's one thing I could have changed, I would go back 3 years and not reveal the discovery, that is, the facts of the case, to the media and then to the public. And we might have been able to get a jury that that was more balanced and more reasonable, in my opinion.
Was there ever any talk of a plea bargain?
Yes, in the trial, about a week before the end of the trial, a week or so, Mr. Mason, one of the defense attorneys, approached Linda Drain Burdick, my co-counsel, and started talking to her about the possibility of a plea, and they had sort of come together and reached an offer, if you will, to allow the defendant to plead guilty to second-degree murder for a 30-year sentence in prison. And, you know, that was going to be discussed with the defendant. And when Mr. Mason attempted to discuss it with her, her reaction, as he described it, was kind of like a blank expression, just not saying no, but just sort of acting as if she didn't know what a plea bargain was or didn't have a concept of what he was trying to talk to her about. So he asked the judge to have her evaluated to see if she had some mental competency problems, and eventually that was done, and, you know, they said she was fine, and I assume she rejected the offer. But that was discussed toward you know, after our case was done, and their case was about in the middle, they started wanting to talk about that.
Okay.
Jeff, are you angry or bothered that Casey Anthony got away with murder?
You know, I'm bothered. I wouldn't say I'm angry. You know, I've been doing this work for 30 years, and this is not the first you know, jury verdict that I was shocked by, and you know, didn't happen the way I thought. And you know, you go through a process, and there is anger at one point, but you know, you get past that pretty quickly because you know, you've been doing this a long time, and you've got to move on to do the next thing. So I wouldn't say I'm angry. I'm just, you know, I'm still disappointed. You know, it's difficult to put 3 years of your life and 6 weeks of intense work into a project to have a jury, you know, basically reject it in a very short period of time. That's a little difficult to deal with. But, you know, you move on and you try to help people process it and move on in a positive kind of way.
Okay. Well, now that you've retired, are you still working in law?
Somewhat, yeah. My retirement from the state attorney's office was followed after a couple of weeks with the beginning of work on the book, which was a very intense process, you know, over that 3 or 4 month period. So I don't think I've really had a period when I was truly, truly retired, but I actually am associated with a firm here in Maitland, which is one of the cities near Orlando. Traum & Walsh is the name of the firm, and you know, I'm doing some work with them. I'm just sort of a part time. You know, I'm available to be a consultant or to defend a client. I think that's a noble thing to do. So I'm doing a little bit of legal work, but I'm not full time. I'm kind of enjoying, you know, the process of getting the book out and talking about it.
Well, we have been honored and proud. You've been a wonderful guest on Chit Chat Cafe Live. We are purchasing the book, Imperfect Justice, as Christmas gifts to all of our family and friends, and we can't thank you enough, Jeff,
well,
for joining
for having
us.
Me. Thank you so much for having me.
If
thank
you think
Jeff.
Of Chit Chat Cafe
so
Live again and would care to join us on a different topic, get in touch.
You betcha. Thank you very
we
much.
We think you did a great job on the case.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You did. You were
we
great.
We were convinced you were guilty.
Enjoy
appreciate
your family.
It.
And we heard a rumor, perhaps a movie. It would be wonderful.
Yeah, that apparently is in the works. It is in the works. So we'll
cool.
have to see how that comes out. You all have a wonderful holiday.
You too.
Well,
thank you
so very much.
You too.
Thank you
so
very much.
Bye.
Goodbye.
Well, it's wonderful, wonderful. Wasn't it, girls?
Yeah, it was really cool.
We put in over 150 hours in our research, the three of us, and we were just so honored to have Jeff Ashton speak with us. We highly recommend the book. Page after page, it just, you can't put it down. We are thanking our fabulous sponsors tonight for Chit Chat Cafe Live, Laura Geller Makeup. She's on QVC right now, by the way, if anyone would care to order. Intimacy Bras and St. Croix Orthopedics. We're also thanking our fabulous producer, Corey King. You can enjoy his show, The Corey King Show, every Wednesday night, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Artist First.
And we'd like to thank our guest, Jeff Ashton, reminding everyone to listen to our archives. You just go on our website, www.artistfirst.com, go to Chit Chat Cafe Live, scroll down our site, and when you see our old archives, just click on the date, and you can listen while you're playing on Facebook or doing work and enjoy some of our past shows.
Thank you for joining us tonight on Chit Chat Cafe Live. I'd like to leave you with a quote from Jeff Ashton. As long as you are persistent, justice will win. God bless you always, Kaylee. And thank you, girls.
Bye.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.